are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Thursday, March 8th, 2018. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America. Downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Professor Richard D. Wolff. On late-stage capitalism and what's next. Also on the program today, tariffs have Trump and GOP in a tizzy.
I was so excited about that.
If I could have come up with a T for Republicans, I could have done the entire thing literally. Well. Strikes and protests around the world hail International Women's Day. Is the Republican Party abandoning the Pennsylvania 18th District ship? And on the heels of a net neutrality win, Washington State about to pass a big suite of very positive voter reforms. And why is Donald Trump so nervous about Stormy Daniels? We'll ask the professor. Canadian doctors have a salary demand that will blow your mind. And Blackwater's Eric Prince, emissary for the Trump administration, may go down on perjury charges.
Does not blow my mind.
No. And Florida passes new gun restrictions, arms some school marshals, but still does it in the face of NRA whining. All this and more on today's program, ladies and gentlemen. All right, we're starting just a hair early today to accommodate our guest because we want to have enough time with him. Folks, I think you know by now, Casper is a sleep brand that continues to revolutionize its line of products to create an exceptionally comfortable sleep experience one night at a time. With three mattress models, the original Casper, the Wave, and the Essential, Casper mattresses are perfectly designed to soothe and cradle your natural geometry. Not to mention the breathable design helps you sleep cool, regulates your body temperature throughout the night. You know, I read both those things, and I got to tell you, honestly, true. I have now two, we have two Casper mattresses in the house. It's awesome. I am now sleeping on a Casper mattress that is so far untainted by my now five-year-old's nighttime peeing. And it's pretty exciting. But it's true. I honestly, like as I was reading that, I was like, you know what? It does. It gives me support. My natural geometry is a little bit rounder than it probably should be. But and it's a cool sleep, which is hugely important to me. It's delivered right to your door in a small, how do they do that size box with free shipping and returns in the U.S. and Canada. That is also true. I just recently opened one of those boxes. And the thing, it's pretty insane how they get it in there. I don't know how they do that. But the best part is that you can be sure of your purchase with Casper's 100-night risk-free sleep-on-it trial. If I want in like 65 days, I think now, 70 days, I could say, you know what, doesn't work for me.
That would be very capricious of you.
I would be very surprised at this point because so far, I don't know how many nights it's been, but it's been pretty comfortable. After all, you spend one-third of your life sleeping, or in my case, just lying up and staring at the ceiling. So you should be comfortable. Get $50 toward select mattresses by visiting casper.com/majority and using majority at checkout. I have the Casper. I have the original Casper in both cases. The Wave and the Essential look pretty good, though. That's casper.com/majority. Offer code majority for $50 off your mattress purchase. Terms and conditions apply. All right, ladies and gentlemen, we just want to give you a coda on a couple of stories today. We're going to do this. One is a little follow-up on the West Virginia strike. A little follow-up on the Texas primaries. But also, we want to close out what was a very crazy couple of days involving our new favorite human being, Sam Nunberg. And Sam Nunberg, of course, is the Trump advisor, former Trump advisor, who was subpoenaed over the weekend, freaked out, and had like 22, I think it was, I have no idea, media hits on Monday. Over the course of the day, you could actually watch this guy have a breakdown in real time. That's never fun. But fortunately, it seems like he recovered, and he was on the radio with WABC with Rita Cosby and I think Curtis Sliwa, although he may have been out for the day with a cold. And, well, this is what Nunberg is saying now.
Sam, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. It's an honor. And Rita, thank you for calling me yesterday. It's very nice. You're a very great friend.
Absolutely. And we saw so many of the headlines, you know, that were going on. Sam, you're calling here to set the record straight. Tell us what you want to say.
Well, I'll just take from my perspective. Look, I've worked for Donald Trump for many years. And before that, I watched him. He was able to control news cycles. And I had received a subpoena, which I want to say was much easier to do than I initially thought. But I had received a subpoena on a Friday. I was supposed to get it in by Wednesday by a certain time, which I believe I'll make that deadline. And I just had enough. I just decided that, you know, let me be the first person where you can call in. You'll control the cable news cycle. It'll be something nobody's ever seen. And I could be the first one to talk about what this is like, what it's like that I have to go, you know, organize this. I have to hire a lawyer, which is fine. I have a great lawyer in Patrick Brackley. And then I have to go into these question sessions, and you have to be extremely precise, which is not a problem for me, but there's a lot of risk there. I mean, I'm a lawyer. I know I'm pretty good at answering these questions.
I don't know
about
that.
But you just need to be extremely precise. So, as you both know, Roger Stone is a very close, call him a mentor. And the questions they were asking, things about him, and I don't think he did anything, I'm not saying that, but I also felt I wasn't going to be used as a pawn for them to get him.
So there you have it. Much easier than he thought to cull through and filter emails.
I had no idea. Keyword search. Keyword. I'm actually very proficient at it.
There you Boolean go. Operators.
Control F.
Can you believe it? Can you believe it? I just went in. I could just put in their last names.
Sam Cedar was trying to find where he was on the BuzzFeed list yesterday on his program. And I found a Control F because of that nice vegan lady who was a co-host. She suggested it.
And Control F. And there it is. And I did it. And I wanted to control the media, the cycle. And I decided the best way to do that was to drink a half a bottle of bourbon and let it roll.
Apparently, so being deeply unbalanced and obnoxious only works for the president.
There you go. All right, folks. Well, it looks like Sam Nunberg is back on track. And I don't know. I guess it's just we await his new TV show that will debut on Fox probably in about 6 weeks. All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Professor Richard DeWolf.
Wait for my candle. The wax is almost
We are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report. It is a pleasure to welcome back to the program Professor Emeritus of Economics at University of Massachusetts Amherst, now visiting professor at the New School, the founder of Democracy at Work, and the host of Economic Update, Richard D. Wolf. Welcome back to the program, Richard.
Thank you, Sam. Glad to be here.
And I have to say, you know, we've done now of this iteration of the show about almost 2,000 episodes. And so I've forgotten a lot of people who are on. But some people I feel like, oh, we just had them on like 6 months ago. And so I want to apologize. It's been almost 6 years and since we've had you on. And I literally have been saying, like, oh, we had them on like 6 months ago. So thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
I was going to start with a question about Stormy Daniels, but I'm going to put that for the back burner.
Okay. It's not my expertise.
All right, fair enough. All right, well, let's go right towards your expertise. Give us an overview of where we're at in terms of, I mean, we spoke 6 years ago. We were closer to the wake of the financial crisis. There was an emerging movement out of Occupy Wall Street. And really, I mean, give us a sense of where you think we are in terms of people's acceptance of Marxist thought, of socialism, broadly speaking, relative to even, let's say, 8 or 10 years ago.
Well, I'd be glad to. And it's easy. It's a new world. It's a quantum leap from what was to what is. Let me explain. Most of my life growing up here in the United States, I was born in Ohio and I've lived all my life and worked all my life here in America. I lived through what now is called the Cold War. That is, I came of age at a time when the big bad enemy was the Soviet Union, and anything and everything having to do with communism, socialism, you name it, was evil and bad and something you should stay as far away from as you possibly could in every way. If it ever came near you, go the other way and so forth. Now, and particularly this is true since 2010, I would say, all of that has changed. In a sense, the Soviet Union is obviously gone as a political entity, but much more important than that, it's that this capitalist system that touted itself to all of us as the greatest thing since sliced bread clearly isn't. The crash of 2008 brought that home to everybody except the most diehard who don't want to face what's going on. And when we spoke 6 years ago, we were in the early phases of coping with what this capitalist crash meant. Now, 6 years later, we can see in its full form that this is a system that capitalism, I mean now, that is simply not working very well for the vast majority of people. And we can see it, if we're willing to look at it, almost anywhere. But the place I'd start is in politics, where all of the old political conventions, the old political parties, the old political type of candidates, the old set of political assumptions, all of those are gone. We are in a new world in which the old parties are increasingly being voted out of office. That's what happened in Greece. That's what happened in Italy last weekend. It's the end of all of that. We're confronted first with an unthinkable new politics in an African-American president, Obama, followed by, in a different way, an unthinkable politician on the extreme right, Mr. Trump. And we kind of see the spinning out of control of a society that is struggling, even with much denial, with the fact that the economic system it assumed would last forever is in very deep trouble. And so I think the openness, the interest in alternatives, socialist, and even others that don't have those convenient labels, is on a high. And I can tell you from my own experience running around the country giving talks, the weekly radio and TV program I now do, that that the interest is like nothing I had seen in the 40 years before 2010.
All right. So with that said, and the manifestation of the failure of capitalism to satisfy the broad base of people in the country, what's the next step? I mean, you know, today in the Washington Post, Elizabeth Bruning, and maybe there has been a columnist who's written a piece like this, but you know, I don't recall it, and I'm 50 years old. I don't recall reading something like this in the Washington Post, in a national paper. It's time to give socialism a try. That's pretty astounding, and you may have a better sense of that than I. But so what's the next step here? I mean, is it still identifying capitalism and the nature of our capitalism as the problem? And what do you say to people who say, well, okay, capitalism is not inherently broken. It is just that the reforms that we place upon it have been damaged.
I'm afraid I'm one of those who says it's the system is busted. It's been broken for a while. We've papered it over with a mixture of scotch tape and rubber bands and a lot of denial of what's going on. And those excuses, if you like, those short-term palliatives just are not working. I mean, let me again explain briefly. Starting in the 1970s, we had three basic phenomena that changed our economic system. Number one, corporations were sick and tired, capitalist corporations, of paying the high wages that had been pushed and forced out of them by the labor movement and by the left, particularly after the crash of the 1930s. They had always been disgusted by that, but they hadn't been able to do much about it since they were stuck here. The world had changed, and they now became unstuck. What do I mean? They were able to bring much lower waged workers into the United States. That's immigration. They were able, because of the internet and jet travel, to move their production out of the United States to capture lower wage workers in other parts of the world. And with the invention of the computer, they were able to use computer, robotics, and now artificial intelligence to replace vast numbers of workers with cheaper machines. And the end result of those three events was that the rising wages of the American working class, which had been a feature of America for 150 years, was over. It was over in the 1970s. It has never returned since. The fact that we teach our students what we call the real wage, what you get paid adjusted for the prices you have to pay. The real average wage in the United States today is the same thing it was in the late 1970s. All of the increase in wages has been offset by the rising prices, leaving you no better off. The American working class has been really cut off at the knees, and the society has spent itself in the last 30 to 40 years denying what I just said, even though the statistics are there for everyone to see, and covering it over. The biggest single palliative, credit. Making everything that we do, whether it's a bottle of water we buy at the corner store, on over to the education for our kids, is now paid for by borrowing money because we can't afford to do it any other way. And it doesn't take a genius to understand that the time will come when the rising debts you collect can't be handled by the wages that are not going up. And that's what happened in 2008. Right. And so people now understand that this capitalist system that ran us through these last 30 or 40 years is literally exhausted. And I think all over the world, people are beginning to ask, gee, what about that socialism that we badmouthed so long? Is there something there that could solve the problem that we have? And it's not just a columnist in the Washington Post. The polls show, for example, today in Great Britain, that if there were an election today, the party that would win is the Labour Party, and the new leader would be Jeremy Corbyn.
Right.
He describes himself as a socialist. He's sort of the Bernie Sanders, if you like, of that country. And they're not that different from us. So, yeah, I think Americans are in the process of reevaluating all of their thoughts about these subjects. I would caution that because we as a nation have not paid attention to what socialism is, other than to badmouth it for 50 years, we are not yet aware. We're just beginning to understand that what socialism means to people has changed over the last 50 years. We're kind of behind the ball. For many socialists today, for example, it has nothing to do with giving the government a greater role, which is what a lot of people think if you haven't paid attention for 50 years. For example, today in the world, more people think of socialism as going from a top-down hierarchical company to a worker co-op type of company, making the production of goods and services something that really is democratically owned and operated by the collection of workers who go there and the collection of customers who use it. That kind of a notion of socialism, which a lot of people don't even attach the word to, is actually what is the ascendant idea of a socialist alternative. Well, Americans are going to have to learn that before they can even debate the pros and cons.
Well, let's teach the Americans that are listening to us now. I mean, because that is even in the context of the piece I just cited, there's not necessarily it's time to try socialism, but there's not really a clear definition as to what that
it is.
Means.
Exactly.
Yeah. So give us sense of like what would that look like? And because, where are we in the development of socialism? I mean, it's like you're suggesting it's maybe the concept is not as associated with statism in the same way that it was 40, 50
exactly.
years ago. But where, what would it be? I mean, if we could hand it over to you for a day, and maybe that's not necessarily how it should work process wise, I guess that's the point. But what would be the roadmap if people were going to vote on it? What would they be voting on?
Well, I will answer the question, but before I do, I want to put all the honesty I can into the answer and to say that socialists don't agree on this subject. In other words, if you asked me what is the socialist alternative, I can't answer that question because there isn't one. The collapse of the Soviet Union, for example, after 1989, the big changes in China, in Cuba, in Vietnam, have made all socialists have to go back, in a sense, to the drawing boards to rethink what they mean. Those societies did not survive in the way that they had been prior to, say, 1985 or 1990. And you have to face that. You can't pretend that this didn't happen. So that socialists have been arguing and debating and changing what they think, and they aren't all of a mind at this moment. I will tell you what I think in answer to your question, but I wouldn't want it to be misunderstood that what I'm about to say is the universally agreed notion. Having said that, let me tell you what it means to me. It does not mean, let me begin by saying, it does not mean what it once did. It does not mean that the state becomes the owner operator of factories and farms and offices and stores. Whatever that experience was in the 20th century, it had good results, for sure. It also had awful results. And the awful results had a lot to do with giving the state that much power that would allow it then to abuse that power in ways that we're all too familiar with. So socialists have learned all of that. They are not stupid and they're not blind. And so one of the results has been to conceive of a transition to a situation better than and different from capitalism in the following alternative way. It becomes a focus on the workplace, that place where the adult, for example, here, the adult American citizen spends most of his or her life. Once you reach adulthood, 5 days of the week, you are working more and more. This is true of women as well as men. For all the reasons we know, and that the result is, if a socialist alternative is visible is projectable, well, then it has to do with the workplace. And here the idea then becomes pretty simple. We ought to be, as socialists, advocates for the democratization of the workplace, having the workplace be the emblem of, the model of what democracy is. And by that I mean the following. If you are affected by a decision at the workplace, then you must, by rights, by democracy, have a role in making that decision. Just like we arrange that the mayor in our town, who has power to make decisions that affect us, must be in turn subject to our power, for example, at the ballot box, so that there's some control. We don't have that in the workplace. You go to work in the morning, you cross the threshold into your office, your factory, your store, and you enter a place where there is no democracy, where a tiny group of people, usually in a corporation, board of directors, major shareholders, that's 20, 25 people in most companies, those folks make all the decisions. They decide what you produce. They decide the technology of how you produce it. They decide the location of where the factory or the office will be, for example, in New York or in Shanghai or in Sao Paulo, Brazil. And then most importantly, at the end of the year, they decide, this tiny group of people, what is to be done with the profits that all of you, all of the employees, helped to produce. This produces an economic system that is owned and operated by a tiny number of people who we now see all around us make sure that this system is good for them. That's why the rich have gotten richer and the rest of us haven't. If you want an economic system to work for all the people, then you have to put all the people in charge. Otherwise, it won't work for the mass of people and will have the kind of lopsided inequality that has become worse across the last 40 years. For me, the socialist alternative has to do with this dramatic, radical, if you want to call it, transformation in which we do something which those of us who believe in democracy believe should have been done long ago, which is to bring democracy into the workplace. If it's good enough for the neighborhood you live in, the residential area you inhabit, then it ought to be applicable to your workplace as well.
So how does that work in practice? So the government passes a law that says any entity that is chartered as a corporation must have this built into their bylaws. I mean, how does that come about?
Exactly. Good. That's a great question. Let me answer it. Rather than speculating how it might be, let me tell you how, as it happens, the British Labour Party right now is doing that. Mr. Corbyn has as his chief economic spokesperson a man named John McDonnell, and he has articulated how they plan to do this in Great Britain when they win the next election. Here's the plan. Number one. It has two parts, so it's really not complicated. Number one, a law will be passed, just as you said, that will have the following provision. Any company in Great Britain, any factory, any office, any store, can continue as it is now for as long as it stays in its current form. But if it should come to the decision either to, one, close itself down, or two, sell itself to another company, or three, move out of Great Britain to another country, or four, become a public company, that is, issue shares and all of that, before it can make any one of those changes, it has to give, here comes the key point, it has to give what's called right of first refusal to its own workers to buy the company and convert it into a democratically owned and operated worker co-op. And when he explains all of that, and the audience kind of takes it in, he then says, and I know what's in your mind, I'm going to tell you how we're going to solve problem number two, which is, where are the workers going to get the money to enable themselves to buy that company? And he smiles and he says, that's when the government of Great Britain will lend the workers that money precisely in order to develop steadily over time a worker co-op sector of the British economy so that the British people can tangibly see the difference between working in a democratic workplace as opposed to the conventional capitalist hierarchical one, then the people can decide if they want to buy from the one kind of enterprise rather than the other because they support one or the other. That's how they're going to do it. That's not the only way to do it. Right. May not be the way we do it, but it is a practical way that this idea is already happening.
It's the functional equivalent of what the public option was supposed to be in the context of the Affordable Care Act when that was proposed. I mean, on some level, right? Where we have
It's basically saying we're going to widen the range of choices that people have. We're going to utilize the government to do that. I would caution people because sometimes when I explain this, there's a bit of a pushback when people say, well, the government is favoring them. I like to remind them as a professor of economic history that the capitalist sector of the American economy has been going to the government to help them in countless ways.
Of course.
From yes. day one. All that's being said here is what you have always done and continue to do for the capitalist sector, you ought also to match by enabling the cooperative alternative sector to show what it can do and to appeal to the American people to make a rational choice about their economic system rather than being forced to live in only one kind.
Governments pick winners and losers every single day. Ask, Gary Cohn why he's so happy that he's only going to be paying 15% tax on his his investments, as opposed to the higher taxes we'll pay if it was wages. I mean, that's just as a beginning. All right, so if that's what's happening in the context of the workplace, what are the implications if we take the next step in terms of government? And I ask that because I wanted to, and I know we're working a little bit against the clock here, but I ask that because one of the things that has come up on this program as we talk about socialism is to what extent, and I'm curious as to your perspective on modern monetary theory, because I think this audience is fairly familiar with the concept. We've talked about it a lot. And that is simply that a government that controls its own currency cannot go bankrupt and has the ability to print money. It doesn't need to tax to spend. There's other reasons to tax. It creates value in a currency, but it doesn't need to tax to spend. I'm curious as to your perspective on modern monetary theory, and if you accept it, your perspective on whether or not it can provide, in lieu of a socialist agenda, I guess, for the government.
Well, the first thing is easy. We have a long history in the United States of acting, and I'm a product of the economic teaching system of American universities, of acting as though the single most important issue in economics is the debate over whether there should be more or less governmental intervention into the economy, whether Keynes was a good guy who saved the system or an evil person who corrupted it, et cetera, et cetera. And in that debate, once it was won in large measure after the 1970s by Thatcher, Reagan, and all of that, the rising to prominence of Milton Friedman and all that he represented, in those last 30 to 40 years, we have demonized the government in every way possible. And that meant there couldn't be the kind of rational investigation of the power to print your own currency and all that it implied. I take my hat off to the modern monetary theorists for having broken that taboo by showing carefully and systematically through a series of important contributions that the government's ability to utilize the power of printing money, of controlling the money supply, goes far beyond what that stale old debate allowed people to explore and to think about. So, yes, I have no problem with that. And I, of course, like it in part because it frees the government up to be less hemmed in by the notion of government debt and what that represents than it once was. And so it'll have the funds to do the kinds of support of social change that I'm talking about. I wish the modern monetary theorists would be more engaged in the conversation about what they could use government money for in the way of supporting social transformation, since for me, that's the key issue. But whether or not they do it, we're going to do it, because for us, it's just one more overcome obstacle to the kinds of change at the workplace that we advocate.
Interesting. So modern monetary theory would allow for acceptance of that would allow for an easy debate over, you know, how the government can fund the worker purchase of a workplace.
Absolutely. And the only question then would be, which the modern monetary theorists understand, that you do have to remember the lesson, which is older than capitalism, that there has to be a carefully maintained balance between the monetary mechanism on the one hand and the production of goods and services on the other,
right,
so that these two things do not get out of whack and produce runaway inflations whose social consequences we have learned all too bitterly can be very destructive. But that will be kept in mind, but the government will not be told, quote unquote, you cannot afford to undertake this or that measure that is good for economic production, good for jobs, or in the case I'm talking about, good for a change in the social structure of production. Because of some limiting of the government's funding ability.
And just to lay person that up a little bit, in other words, you can't get net inflation. Modern monetary theorists believe you cannot get inflation simply by printing money. But however, if you do charge up the economy and create enormous demand, or you have obviously some type of supply shock, you can get inflation there. But that's simply just, you know, keeping your eyes open, more or less.
True, but if you are politically sensitive, if you understand the politics of this, you have to be very careful, since it's not symmetrical. Well, the ability to spend more money on the part of the government is not identical to the reverse of spending less. The political costs and difficulties of the one are not the same as the other. So that, yes, we can say that the government can rein in what it does when an inflation is looming or a problem, that's not quite the same thing, or at least it hasn't been in our political practice, to what is at stake in spending more money. And I think, therefore, you're going to have to be careful. You can't quite sweep under the rug the problems of a disconnect between money and real goods and services in the way that, on the reverse, the people against modern monetary theory think you're living inside a straitjacket. You're not in a straitjacket, but you're not in a free form either.
Okay, fair enough. And just to clarify as well, if we institute that program of in the context of Great Britain, they're talking about instituting that program of worker, a sort of a public option for worker ownership of certain businesses. And, you know, I think maybe for some of our audience, that feels sort of hard to imagine. For others, I mean, I that's where I do my shopping, in a supermarket. Yeah. That is exactly that. And where I live, you know, in New York City, there's a lot of co-op buildings.
That's right. I live in one, and I can assure you it's been here for many, many decades, and there's not the slightest problem with them, at least none that are any different from any other kind of ownership structure. It has its unique issues, but it is something that most of us who are in such co-ops, and there are hundreds of thousands of us in New York City, are very happy and glad that we can preserve. I should answer one thing you just said, too, that here in the United States, worker ownership is already an established reality across the United States, and it has been for decades.
Right.
These are often called ESOPs, Employee Stock Ownership Plan or Program is what it stands for. And many companies have, for a variety of reasons over the decades, decided that they want to sell their business at a certain point to their own workers. Let me give you the simplest example. And this happens a lot. The initiative might surprise you. It doesn't come in many cases from the workers, in some, but in many cases it comes from the employers, the owners. Take an example, a simple example. Mr. and Mrs. Smith started a company 50 years ago as a young couple. They've worked real hard, and now they are in their middle or later 60s, and they have 284 employees, and they're doing real well, and they're an asset to the local community from which those workers come. But they've had enough. They've worked hard. They need a retirement. They want to go off in the RV and explore the national parks and all the rest. Their kids are into other lives, so they don't have children to leave it to. Here's their options. One, they can close the business, but that's to destroy their life's work. They don't want to do that. Plus, it puts that terrible situation for the 284 people they've hired, most of whom they know personally. So they don't want to do that. And for the same reason, they don't want to sell it to another corporation, which could the day later make the same kind of awful decision. And they don't want to make it a publicly owned company with a stock market, again, for the same reasons. So it turns out when folks like us meet with them, that when we explain, here's another option you may not have thought of, sell it to your own workers, this actually is a better outcome for them than any of the other alternatives. So you don't have to twist people's arms. You don't have to beg or plead or make long-winded argument. You can show in a very practical way, and this has been done, that this is a way to preserve the jobs for the people that have been giving you their work for years. It preserves the tax base of the community in which the enterprise is located. It's a better solution, and it is happening already. For me, it's half the steps that we need. The other half is, it's one thing for workers to own something. It's another thing for workers to democratically operate that. That has to be almost a kind of cultural movement now in America, to get workers to understand that the same logic that said, we don't want a king to decide over us, we don't want to be the subjects of a king, we want to be recognized as having the ultimate power in our political life, that the same ought to apply in our work life. We are the people who live with the results of the economy. We should be in a powerful position to shape the decisions. And if that happens, then you could get not only worker ownership, which we already have, but real worker democratic running of the enterprises. And here's the final benefit of it all. We complain in America, folks like you and me, that the political life of our country is damaged in terms of its democracy by the huge number of people that don't care or don't seem to care about our elections or our political processes, who either don't vote or don't acquaint themselves with what's going on, et cetera, et cetera. Well, one of the reasons political democracy has the rough time it does being real in America is because we don't have it at the workplace. Nothing would make our political system more democratic than having it married to an actually democratic economic system, which we have not yet tried in the history of the U.S.
Isn't all of, you know, when we talk about this in the context of Great Britain, though, there's you already have a very robust social services from the state that that we don't have in the United States. You have literally a government-run healthcare system, even as opposed to a government-run health insurance system. And you have a whole host of other social services that make the life and I guess the what we would call the social reproduction, more comfortable outside of the workplace. I mean, when does that fold in? Because, you know, frankly, look, I'm in a co-op for my supermarket. I'm a co-op of my house. I'm a co-op in my nursery school, and you know it's good, but you know there's still a lot of things that I got to deal with in the context of this society that I'm not necessarily. You know, sometimes, like everything, one of these places is a pain in the butt at different times. But there are other issues that I have that, I mean, so don't we need the whole package there? I mean, what about that other aspect?
Well, I'm in the very comfortable position, precisely because of the things you point to, of being able to say, I don't need, I don't want, and I don't advocate a 100% worker co-op based economic system. All I want, and I'm very confident about this, is to actually give the American people some real choice. You know, we as Americans love to tell ourselves about how we are about freedom of choice and all of the rest of it. It's funny, you know, if we are, then how come we're stuck with one kind of economic arrangement in our workplaces, the capitalist one, the hierarchical one, the fundamentally undemocratic one I just described? So I only want the choice. Let's have the government develop a real worker co-op sector where workers own but also run collectively and democratically the enterprises they depend on. And then let the people, once there is a real sector like that going on, that they can see how it works, that they can talk to friends and neighbors who work there, who shop there, etc., then let us have the, which is long overdue, the real democratic process of deciding just what you put out. What portion, what kinds of activities would we like to see run in a cooperative way, and what would we like not to go in that direction? If and when and after we've had the experience that says, okay, this kind of organization may not work in that circumstance, so we'll leave it to be run that way, whereas in this case, we would prefer to have it done this way. Let's give the choice. For me, that is so much better than the limited, one-sided arrangement we have now that I can be very generous and expansive in advocating nothing more than that. No insistence in some abstract way that everything be done in manner X just because I don't like how it's being done now in manner capitalist.
All right. So so the theory is that once folks get a taste of this, it will empower certain people and it will entice certain people. But haven't we seen almost the opposite of that when it comes to, say, like unionism? Because... you know, the data is quite clear. You work for a union, you make 10-11% more. Even your industry, even if you don't, even if you aren't covered by a union, you're making more. You get better benefits. I mean, yet we have seen a political system which has been stifling unions over the past 40-50 years, I should say. I mean, so. I mean, what's the how do we know that program is going to be enough, and how do we know that it's going to be distributed enough that people are going to take as much advantage of it across the country that our political system, the way that it's structured now, can be responsive to people saying, like, I like it?
Well, I think your question is great. Unfortunately, I can't give you any kind of guarantee. I don't much believe in guarantees wherever they come from, so I'm not going to start offering them myself. I would say this to give you some reassurance. If a large part of an economy like the American or the British or any other were to be organized under the form of worker co-ops, my guess is that you would have none of the kinds of lopsided anti-labor, anti-co-op, culture, politics, ideology, choking the society. You'd have a real debate. You'd have all of the government officials who depend on worker co-ops to pay their tax bills and revenues, who depend on worker co-ops and what they think about the government when they shape the attitudes of voters who come out of those co-ops. In other words, if you give those co-ops a real important political position in the society, you are creating, in a way, the political base, the political support for a change, both in the politics, but also in the larger culture. And I think that's what we've had missing in this country. You had a preponderance of the wealth in this society concentrated in the hands of the people who have become richer over the last 45 years, whether you want to call them the 1% or the 5%, really doesn't matter. It's a very small percentage of our people who sit atop the capitalist system, who have made it work very well for them. And they are not stupid. If you live in a society where a small number of people are getting richer relative to everybody else, and yet that society has universal suffrage, everybody votes, you're in danger as a rich person that at any time the mass of people who are not rich but who are the majority are going to think about using their vote, their political position, to undo the inequality created by capitalism as an economic situation. And therefore, in order to keep yourself on top of this system, you have to be none too subtle about this, by the political system. You have to make the organizations, the organs of politics, the political parties, and the candidates, and the whole machinery of it, dependent on your money. Otherwise, you're putting yourself at risk. We would change that whole dynamic if we had a large part of our society organized in a cooperative, democratic way that is experienced by people every day on the job. They are not going to permit undemocratic, anti-democratic political and cultural phenomena to have the freedom to choke everybody else out of the picture the way they've had in this country for the last half century.
Richard Wolff, I wish we had more time today, and we'll have to do this again much, much sooner than our last time. I feel like we barely scratched the surface of the things that I want to talk about. But folks can get more information over at democracyatwork.info. They can, of course, listen to your radio show and TV show, The Economic Update. Richard Wolff, thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Sam. I couldn't agree more. And if you want to do this again in the near future, please get in touch. I'd love to continue the conversation.
Oh, great. All right. Thank you again. Bye-bye.
Take care.
All right, folks. Wow, that's fun. All right. We're going to head into the other fun half today. Number 646-257-3920, and you can IM us if you have the app at majorityapp.com. Folks, just a reminder, it is your support that makes this show possible. We do the show every day, put out about 45, it tends to be closer to probably like 55 minutes. Free show. We do it because our members support this program. And as a way of saying thank you, we give you extra content every day. You don't want it? You don't have to listen to it. That's okay. We're not going to make you listen to it. You don't want to listen to the first half? You just want to listen to the second half? You can do that too. You want to listen to one quarter of the first half and one quarter of the second half? You can do that.
I was going to say you can't do that.
You can do that.
At a certain point, it just gets odd.
Well, no, I mean, let me put it this way. You're constrained only by your ability to jump around in a podcast. We just give it to you and you do whatever you want with it. Use it as a paperweight. But we can't do any of it without you, our members. So if you have the means to become a member, please do so at jointhemajorityreport.com. However, if you don't have the means to do so yet, you want the extra content. A lot of people do. They're out of work. They're doing stuff that maybe they're helping family who are sick, or they're in school or whatever it is. Just send us an email, majorityreporters@gmail.com. Have patience. I'm chronically behind in responding to emails. But it is your support that makes this show possible. Also, speaking of co-ops, there's one we talk about every single day on this program. And what they do is they sell coffee, tea, and chocolate. And they do it in Madison, Wisconsin. And, you know, perfect example of the type of people who get involved in these things and what it does to those people. They were, you know, back in the big protests in Madison back in 2011, they were giving free coffee to people. And I think they were buying pizzas for people. And they don't even sell pizza. But it's justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, you get 10% off. You know, there's a story coming out of West Virginia, which we'll talk about, that the teacher's strike has, and again, you know, it's very tough to measure these things, right? You won't see it until, but that it has in some ways radicalized and in other ways just simply politicized a lot of the people who were involved in it, people who, you know, saw what it was like to negotiate with a Republican-controlled legislature. And remember, this is a situation in West Virginia where the 5% increase in salaries was not just for teachers, but they got it for all public sector workers. And about 3.6% of the electorate in West Virginia are public sector workers. And I'm not convinced that this dynamic, and, you know, maybe, I don't know, or maybe we'll play one of these days that interview that I did with Lena Putnam, I think her name is, was she on Ring of Fire. She and Theta Scopel did this study about the emerging ad hoc political organizations that have come in the wake of 2016, dominated by largely educated white suburban women whose politics probably as a median start, you know, closer to the center right than certainly I think a lot of the people who listen to this program. But one wonders, once they become politically active, if their ideology is shaped by that experience. Because from my experience, most of the people who are I run into who are centrists, who are not political, don't really follow politics that much and therefore aren't really aware of like the implications of this vote that took place in the Senate the other day, you know, about rolling back financial regulations. I mean, that thing, okay. You're going to hear, you know, there's going to be like a half a dozen people who in 10 years in the next financial crisis are going to point back to that situation. I think Dayan said something like that when we were talking about it the other day. But they just don't see these connections. They don't see them in real time. And it's even that much harder to see them over time. And I mean, I think like, you know, younger people, broadly speaking, seem just anecdotally and from my perspective to be more engaged in politics than previous generations. But I bet even those students from Parkland, and they already seem to be fairly politically savvy, but I suspect that the more of those kids that get involved in this, their political projects are going to become wider than just gun reform. I mean, because when you start to realize, like, hey, wait a second, you ask, why do we have so many guns in this country? And you follow the trajectory, well, there's a reason. It's because there's a tremendous amount of greed. And there's also a healthy dose of racism that underpins and drives that market. And we talked about that I had the book right here. With Dunbar Ortiz, Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz. And I would imagine that you can't help but, you start to read into this stuff and you start to see different connections and you start to realize like we need a bigger, broader project. And I think to some extent, that's what Wolf is arguing. You give people the means in which to engage in their workplace, to own their, to own the means of production there, and then they start to become more aware of what the possibilities are, and things, you know, go from there. I mean, that's, you know, it's a good as argument as any. Start with the first step, and then go from there. And so, so become a member of the Majority Report. Was that where I was going with that? I don't remember. I got off on a tangent. Also, as you know, today is Thursday, which means that Tuesday was 2 days ago, which means that there's still a fairly fresh version of TMBS on your iTunes or your YouTube. And of course, that was also a couple of days ago when Jamie put a new piece on her Patreon at patreon.com/JamiePeck.
Yeah. And they even ran a slightly updated version of it on Left Voice yesterday. Which I'm pretty stoked about. And also, I wasn't going to say anything, but I realized that this is kind of time sensitive. I did, my husband and I did, I'll call it a podcast, a little interview show. And that is
what
going
did you do it on? Did
on you? Our, on my Patreon today.
I was going to do that.
But it's like a soft launch. I wasn't going to say anything because I still feel very shy about it. But then I realized it is today is the International Women's Strike, and this episode is about that. So I should probably tell people about it so they listen to it.
And they can find that at your Patreon.
Yeah, I'm going to link to it on my from my Patreon and all my social media probably.
There you go.
It's free, obviously. It's the
well,
first
we'll
one.
Put it on the we'll put it in today's post too.
Oh, and Matt. I didn't mean to leave Matt out.
I edited it and do some.
Matt is also, it is a worker owned and operated co-op, which someday we'll hopefully have money to share.
There you go. All right, folks. 646-257-3920 is the number, and you can IM the show. See you in the fun half.
Sad.